Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Age of Atlantic Revolution, The Fall and Rise of a Connected World by Patrick Griffin. Narrated by Steve Menash. Prologue. So it all began with some rope. In July 1776, just days after the Declaration of Independence had been adopted, a group of New Yorkers assembled on the Commons to celebrate the break from Britain before marching down to the Bowling Green at the southern tip of Manhattan. Here, a statue to King George III on horseback, replete with classical garb, had been erected only 6 years before. Made of lead, the statue was gilded and rested on a marble pedestal, all of which stood 15 feet high. The General Assembly had commissioned the statue in 1766 because of the innumerable and singular benefits the king had rendered the colony, particularly delivering it lately from the utmost confusion and distress, but repeal of the Stamp Act. No less a personage than John Adams had admired the statue when he had visited the city earlier. Now the New Yorkers meant to pull it down. How things had changed in only a few years. When citizens and soldiers of the Continental Army threw ropes around their sovereign and pulled, they decried, "The folly and pretended goodness of the real George have made upon their minds, which have effectually poisoned and destroyed their souls." With the ropes, as one newspaper in Maryland declared, the knot is cut. The symbolic act of regicide did not end there. The men and women lopped off the head of the statue in a move reminiscent of the execution of Charles I a century earlier and placed it on a pike. One loyalist was able to get his hands on the desecrated and now uncrowned head of the statue, buried it for safekeeping, and then dug it up to send to Britain to a former Lord Lieutenant of Ireland named George Townsend, all to demonstrate the intentions of some of the colonists. The savior of the head had ample reason to worry. The despoilers sent the rest of the statue to Connecticut to be melted down into bullets. In all, 42,088 were made from the metal. The numbers 42 and 88 represented totemic symbols for British nationhood, tied as they were to key events that took place in 1642 and 1688, during which the English decided to topple other kings. These bullets would be used in the fight for liberty that ensued. The New Yorkers hoped the emanations from the leaden George would make deep impressions on the British. Indeed, they would. The toppling of this statue in particular has mythically come to be associated with the loosening of bonds, an untethering from an old order. It would come to be seen as the first scene of the first act of revolution by those living at the time, and for us today. What those with the rope could not quite have articulated were transformations on an epic scale beyond their ability to comprehend fully. Beneath the invocation of ideas, seismic changes were remaking the Atlantic world. As much as by new concepts of the person, of governance, and of the economy, the period was defined by broad systemic shifts to which all people had to adapt. The process that was reshaping a system that touched four continents, North and South America, Europe and Africa, and that reverberated farther still, was both troubling and exhilarating, even if it was not quite understood. States would be challenged to keep up with it. Their officials usually tried to do so by reforming the structures or practices in place, and people, like the New Yorkers, responded in kind. Trite as it sounds, The world was changing profoundly long before the New Yorkers used ropes to announce they would not be tied down. What had been the assumed ways of doing things were now in danger of becoming obsolete. Conventional ideas and ways of organizing politics, the economy, and society could not keep pace with the changing system. Political arrangements tying empires together were ill-equipped to address new concerns. What bound the whole together had become a question, and to some people at least, older ways of appreciating power could not do justice to the challenge of the new. Old symbols no longer fit. The experiences of those on the very edges of that system proved a harbinger of what was to come and what would define the period as an age. How the New Yorkers responded also served as an example, writ small, of the stresses and tensions nearly all societies were to deal with. Concerns that would ensure new statues would arise after old ones fell. From Paris to Port-au-Prince, and from Boston to Buenos Aires, and all the interconnected points in between. Introduction. What these New Yorkers also could not have fathomed is how the tugging of a rope would inaugurate what the Irish radical Dennis Driscoll would call the Age of Revolution. He was hardly alone in making such a bold pronouncement. The much more conservative John Adams intoned in 1815 that ours is the age of revolution and constitutions, yoking the breakdown of authority and its rebuilding in one phrase. In 1762, Jean-Jacques Rousseau had prophesied un siècle de révolution, as had Voltaire in 1772. In his first inaugural address in 1801, Thomas Jefferson referred to the period as an age of revolution and reformation. A generation later, after events in Latin America, Lyman Beecher preached that the period ushered in an age of revolution and war. Almost canonically, the avatar of the promise of the period, Thomas Paine, enthused, it is an age of revolutions in which everything must be looked for. The Age of Revolution transformed all. After the New Yorkers tore down the statue, the spirit of liberty, almost like a current of electricity, would course across America. It would then travel to France, throughout the continent, and the Caribbean, back to the British Isles, and eventually finding its way to Latin America and Africa. The ensuing conflagration destroyed empires and saw a new understanding of the sovereign power of the state arise from these ashes. It unleashed, it spread, it purified. It would, with time, outlaw slavery, remake reigning ideas of political economy, refashion the status of women, and shake the political landscape. Throughout the Atlantic world from the 1760s through the 1820s, nothing and nobody would be untouched. This earlier age made the modern world. As monuments throughout Brazil, Spanish America, all of Europe, Britain and Ireland, North America, the Caribbean, and West Africa attest, the Atlantic was turned upside down in the late 18th and early 19th century. What would have been unimaginable in 1750, say the idea that popular sovereignty would be the bedrock of government, proved the rule rather than the exception by 1830. There is another side. The age begot violence and war. It rode on waves of fear and disorder. It unleashed, it spread, it corrupted. Power was reorganized, as was society, but the tumultuous transition from an old order to a new one did not make for a world of unfettered possibilities. The age ushered in a new era of global empires that would reshape, perhaps decimate, the lives of indigenous peoples across the globe. The age resulted in the reinvigoration of slavery in places, the use of reason to justify the rule of the few over the many, modern and pernicious conceptions of race and subordination, the empowering of states that could overwhelm the individual, the triumph of unregulated free trade that saw whole portions of the earth marginalized to enrich others. The list could go on. It was one of history's hinges, a moment upon which everything turned, often for the worse. The age, as Paine's bete noire, Edmund Burke, came to fear, would fetter many more than it would free. It was, as Charles Dickens said, the best of times and the worst of times. For this reason, and because of the ways this earlier period in the Atlantic marks our world to this day, shelves groan with penetrating interpretations of the age. What sets this book apart? Well, let's return to Paine and Burke for a moment. For a start, consider the bonds between them. They first became personally acquainted over, of all things, a bridge-building scheme Paine was planning. In 1788, Paine wrote Burke a letter as we begin the world without knowing it will be long or short. He knew the length of the span he hoped to construct. The quiet field of science has more amusement to my mind than politics, and I had rather erect the largest ark in the world than be the greatest emperor in it, he told Burke. Burke hosted the great American Paine at his home for some time, and they came to know each other reasonably well. What each saw in the other were the possibilities of connections. Burke understood that Paine was tied to a cadre of first-rate thinkers in both the old world and the new. Few were better networked with the great and the good in the British Isles than Burke. More significantly, of course, the one responded to the other throughout this tumultuous period. Paine, after all, wrote Rights of Man to refute Burke. In fact, Paine opens his preface to the English edition of Rights of Man with these words. From the part Mr. Burke took in the American Revolution, it was natural that I should consider him a friend to mankind. Their acquaintance, as he observed, commenced on that ground. As early as 1777, Burke had characterized the celebrated author of Common Sense as a catalyst that prepared the minds of the people for independence. How that sense of camaraderie changed! By 1790, Burke came to believe Paine was preparing the world for something quite different from liberation. When Paine decided to take aim at the British establishment, Burke wrote, I am happy to find that practical Paineism has not extended itself that way, and that the iron bridge, which I was guilty of introducing, has not yet been like the bridge over Milton's chaos, and high road for all the devils of anarchy to pass. Such growing animosity between the Titans obscures a deeper link. Both participated in networks that spanned the ocean and bound continents together. Both writers saw themselves as part of a broader world of reference points that incorporated places as dispersed as Cartagena and Berlin. All these places, as well as their histories, have been imaginatively amalgamated into a connected whole. And both, Burke and Paine, relied on a common inheritance to try to make sense of what was happening to their world. A span of iron may not have tied them together, but so much more did. This book focuses on such connections. The circulation of people, things, and ideas bound the disparate parts of the Atlantic together, a development that deepened once crisis began. Notions of entanglement and connection, what the French call histoire croisée or histoire connectée, are much esteemed by historians today, perhaps too much so. But no other terms capture more fully what made the 18th century so enthralling and so vexing. The book argues that the changes that transformed the world and made ours were bound up in the many ways men and women tried to make sense of an intensely networked system changing before their eyes. The knotty challenges of the period also tested the abilities of states to manage the Atlantic. The crises that brought on revolution emerged from attempts to disentangle the world. Only when states came into being that could do so would revolution end. Only a new kind of state could rebind what had been unwound. In the process, people transformed themselves. The period illustrated the creative ability of men and women to adapt to wrenching changes and to reshape the societies in which they lived. Even if they remade the Atlantic in unintended or even unfathomable ways, they always did so in light of the many connections tying their world together. From conventional perspectives, the study of the Age of Revolution presents awkward challenges, most especially because the chronologies of the dynamics in so many different places so far from one another do not line up. After all, revolution began in North America in the 1770s and started in Latin America more than a generation later. Moreover, can we characterize what happened far from the Atlantic coast as part of a broader pattern? But if we think of revolution along less conventional and more enmeshed lines, a new chronological and geographic roadmap of the period comes into focus. The American Revolution did not come to a fitting and simple conclusion in 1787. The French Revolution did not simply begin in 1789. Unrest in Spanish and Portuguese holdings before independence movements also had revolutionary implications. What took place in African societies, in places like Prussia, and in Native American communities far from the ocean bore the stamp of the age. When we think of connection, the terms center and periphery can often have less purchase. In fact, a place like Haiti stands at the very heart of the period and its fundamental features because of how it was tied to the broader Atlantic. What happened in one place, then, informed what would occur elsewhere. Pulling the thread in one seemingly isolated corner of a network could have dramatic implications for people and places an ocean away. What follows here is not a conventional history, or a study for that matter. It is, for lack of a better word, a synopsis. I mean this term in the way a scholar of the New Testament would use it. The book does not offer a blow-by-blow account of what happened. What single volume could? It proposes instead a brief look at the whole to outline the stories of the constituent parts. Synopsis implies viewing the whole and the parts that animate it simultaneously. As such, the book moves between broad, systemic changes in many places and the ways men and women in their locales tried to make sense of them, assign meaning to them, and act upon them. Such a synoptic understanding, not so ironically, reached its high point during the age itself, when a German theologian named J.J. Griesbach repurposed an age-old way of viewing three or four Gospels side by side to see how they were connected and what such intermingling meant for the larger story the Gospels propounded. This book does much the same by offering meditations on the beginning, middle, and end of the revolutionary process as it played out across the broad Atlantic in 100 years from 1750 to 1850. It does so by relying on all of the wonderful work done on Atlantic history over the past generation and the many studies of its constituent parts on this critical period. To synopsize means looking at representative cases and relating them to one another and a larger narrative. It invites comparison. In fact, it demands comparison. The Atlantic can only be appreciated in specific contexts. Nevertheless, the specific only makes sense in light of the Atlantic. Comparing particulars helps us appreciate the big picture and its various aspects in more compelling ways. For the beginning, we survey the whole, charting how global patterns of change transformed the Atlantic during the 18th century, necessitating imperial reform. The book then centers on the first society to experience revolutionary tumult, British North America. The American case illustrates how an age of empire became an era of revolution because of a crisis of connection. We then travel to the next places to experience the shocks of the period. Prominent among them, France, Saint-Domingue, and Ireland, to appreciate the central features of revolution during the age. Hope, fear, and aggression. Many of the specifics and the stories surveyed here are well known. The book tries to characterize them anew through the prism of the broader picture presented. We wrap up with a study of endings by charting dynamics in the last region to be pulled into the crucible, Latin America, and one place that seemed by the end of the proverbial day to have held at bay the whipsawing effects of the age, Britain. We do so to understand how men and women in these and other places tried to bring the process of revolution to a close. The final chapter takes us once again through the whole Atlantic, but one now transformed by examining nation-building and memorialization, the final steps in binding the whole and its constituent parts together after the unraveling of the old order. Throughout these studies, other places, often left out of conventional treatments, are folded into this story of the Atlantic Age. In other words, the book weaves the chronological with the geographic and the thematic, just as the local is interlaced with the broader and the comparative with the sequential. The sum total is an understanding of how the Atlantic-wide process unfolded through time. No aspect of the process was hermetically sealed. Revolutionary origins for British North America informed events elsewhere. What happened in Latin America reverberated in the United States, challenging the revolutionary settlement there. Events in the Caribbean shook Brazil, West Africa, and the British Isles. And connections between France and the rest of the world shaped beginnings and endings throughout the Atlantic. The book examines this complex interweaving throughout, just as we would study, say, the Synoptic Gospels. The whole only makes sense when we pull together what are usually seen as discrete dynamics with those occurring far away and when we see how they relate to one another. Once we see things in this way, the age can have apparent and unappreciated beginnings and a number of possible endings. It began when the idea of turning out an old order transfixed people, such as when the New Yorkers grabbed their ropes and beheaded the statue of their king. It also had its start well before people on the ground could even comprehend seismic changes challenging the accepted arrangements of how society was to be structured. A revolutionary era began, therefore, as event and as process, in ways that people could articulate with ideas and in ways they could not. It may have ended that way as well. Similarly, sometimes men and women were conscious of connections, at other times not. Ultimately, men and women tried to give meaning to that which lay just over the horizon of comprehension. As they did so, people throughout the Atlantic debated how to impose the power of the state onto a dynamically changing system. Revolution represented the intense competition to accomplish this feat, and people throughout the Atlantic, whether they liked it or not, were caught up in the process and struggle of articulating the fit between sovereignty and system, as the world seemed to reel around them. Along the way, this book parses the phrase Age of Revolution First, what is an age? It is, of course, a construct, and men and women in the late 18th and early 19th century came to believe they were living during an exhilarating and terrifying, but ultimately epochal moment. They came to such a conclusion by seeing things in places far removed as intrinsically connected. Add to this that the very idea also could have almost talismanic appeal. Such sensibilities captured imaginations at different junctures for different places. When, where, and why matter? Second, the book wonders whether to consider this age a moment of revolution or of revolutions. Think of the difference. The former conjures up a single movement, the second, a series of perhaps connected eventualities. The plural implies national or regional disruptions that could appear distinctive. The singular brings to mind the sum total of all these experiences. Perhaps we should ask how the universal and the particular related. Finally, the book tangles with the question of what a revolution is. Here we get to especially vexing terrain. According to a writer who tried his hand at defining the term many years ago, revolution is one of the looser words. Indeed, the word connotes, of course, some sense of progress and a program for change, the idea that it can be a force unto itself. However, revolution also suggests a process with a beginning, a middle, and an end. When one society after another was remade, and through which sovereignty was recrafted. Could revolution be both at once? The book applies these simple questions to the whole Atlantic. It covers this complicated terrain by taking us through the entangled and connected origins, central features, and conclusions of this stupendous upheaval. It discusses how people struggled through violence, liberation, and war, and in the process, came to imagine themselves and the state in new ways. From this imaginative process, all hinging on finding a form of sovereignty that could manage the imperatives of the international system and of the moment, men and women from North and South America, Africa and Europe, singly and together, would remake the world. Chapter 1. A Tangled World. The Atlantic in the 18th Century. Some of the greatest writers in the 18th century focused their finest work on an age-old paradox that defined the Atlantic on the eve of revolution. The Londoner Daniel Defoe and the Dubliner Jonathan Swift published Robinson Crusoe and Gulliver's Travels in 1719 and 1726, respectively. They would become the two most widely read stories of the 18th century, translated into many European languages. They both suggest the lure of adventure. In Robinson Crusoe, the headstrong young man heads to sea only to be shipwrecked. The ocean captured him and his imagination in the most literal way. "I would be satisfied with nothing but going to sea," Crusoe declares, even to the point of ignoring the will, nay, the commands of my father. Conventional bonds would not hold him. He dreams of escape. He then finds himself in a state of nature and has to reconstruct society from the ground up. Swift's Lemuel Gulliver starts as a mature man, eager to explore, and as a student of medicine and science, to see what makes the world tick. Gulliver claims an insatiable desire of seeing foreign countries. To do so, he knows he has to head to sea. So he teaches himself navigation and other parts of mathematics useful to those who intend to travel. The darker aspects of venturing are evident in both accounts as well. At one point, Gulliver is tied down, forced to do the work of a mean and little people. even as he is ordered by his new tiny masters to overawe their foes and...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?